In 2012, the Harvard Business Review ran a headline declaring that empathy is the most valuable thing they teach at Harvard Business School. Another article from 2015 claims that empathy is the key to a great meeting. A 2018 article gives tips for helping employees empathize with customers, while another offers tips for developing empathy for someone who annoys you. And just this year, HBR offered a guide to sustaining empathy in difficult times. And that's all just a smattering of the 6,000 results that you get when you Google empathy on the HBR website. Empathy, it seems, has made its way into the corporate lexicon. Managers, marketers, executives, and even software engineers are expected to speak the language of empathy today. Of course, it wasn't always this way. Empathy used to be a foreign tongue in boardrooms and corner offices. But the story of empathy doesn't start with a viral TED Talk or best-selling business book. It starts in 1909, when the word empathy was first used in English by psychologist Edward Titchener. As a distinct concept, empathy is pretty new. Or rather, it's newer than its Greek etymology would imply. While empathy does derive from ancient Greek words meaning feeling into, the word empathy was invented in English as a translation of a German word, Einfühlung. Einfühlung means feeling into in German and sort of connotes a displacing or transportive quality of experience. Now, the German word wasn't invented by a psychologist, but by a philosopher of aesthetics. Robert Vischer coined Einfühlung in 1873. Instead of merely observing a sculpture or painting, Vischer thought one could imagine what it would be like to be the sculpture or subject of the painting. And this technique wasn't only for imagining the experience of human subjects, but also animals, mountains, buildings, or anything else. Of course, we don't hear much about the aesthetic version of empathy anymore. Today's version of empathy, the kind that's equally suitable for the TED Talk stage or TikTok, seems like a completely different language from that original use. This version of empathy promises results, influence, wealth, success, and viral marketing campaigns. But is that really empathy? Or rather, what is empathy? And why have the powers that be in the 21st century economy embraced empathy in such a big way? I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. This is the first in a 5-part series exploring empathy. Today, I've got an origin story of sorts, or rather, sort of a few origin stories. Anyhow, in the next few episodes, you'll hear from 4 people whose own work intersects with empathy in interesting ways. You'll hear about brand strategy from NobiWorks founder Chloe Nwangwu, copywriting from Cult of Personality founder Samantha Pollock, disability and accessibility from Mabel EQ founder Aaron Perkins, and nonviolent communication from Leonie Smith of The Thoughtful Workplace. These were 4 really fun, really meaty conversations, and I can't wait to share them with you. But first, as I said, an origin story. So, what really is empathy? Well, that is a very tricky question to answer, it turns out. But to begin, I'll start with my own empathy origin story. I first got interested in empathy because it seemed that I lacked it. I couldn't easily identify my own emotional states, let alone the emotional states of others. I didn't feel the proper things at the proper time. My brain would do one thing, and my face and body language would do something else. In the right circumstances, my unusual reactions made for comic relief. But most of the time, I came across as odd, cold, or even hostile. Now, at the same time I was realizing this, which I should probably mention was in my early 30s, I was also receiving some conflicting positive feedback. People who read my blog would tell me that I was a mind reader. I somehow knew exactly what they were thinking. I could put words to thoughts that they'd never spoken aloud before. So yeah, I was a bit confused. Now, also around this time, I started to teach a design thinking tool to help small business owners get inside the heads of the people they wanted to help. This tool, believe it or not, is called an empathy map. In my own work, I renamed it a perspective map because it seemed more appropriate at the time. Now, let me tell you about a perspective map. A perspective map is very simple. You imagine a few people who are dealing with the kind of problem or have the sort of need that your product or service helps with. Then you take a piece of paper and draw two perpendicular lines so that you have four equal boxes. In the upper left box, you write down everything that the people you're imagining do related to the problem or need they have. In the upper right box, you jot down what they say related to the problem or need. The lower boxes are for what they think and what they feel. This ridiculously simple tool was my magic wand. With it, I could write engaging articles, create compelling sales copy, and plan effective workshops. And without fail, people would tell me that I read their minds. The perspective map was sort of like my decoder ring for the encrypted text of other people's needs. Later, I started to use the perspective map process while I was out and about. Anytime I was in a situation that I didn't quite understand, or didn't know what was expected of me, or didn't know why someone was behaving the way they were, my brain would automatically consult my decoder ring. I'd systematically consider the doing, saying, thinking, and feeling of whatever was going on. Honestly, it rarely helped in the moment. It's not like I was fluent in perspective taking, and that's a lot of mental work to engage in while I'm supposed to be having a casual conversation or, you know, asking for help at a store. But later, when I would debrief with Sean, I found that I could reconstruct a variety of scenarios that might explain someone else's baffling to me behavior. Sean called it my empathy engine. Now, my empathy engine wasn't always helpful. It's not that my analysis was off, but that sharing my analysis wasn't always appropriate. If Sean told me a story about a situation that upset him, my empathy engine would kick in, and I'd helpfully explain the other person's side of the story. Well, Sean didn't need to know what the other person might have been thinking. He needed me to commiserate with him and recognize his feelings. That lesson took me quite a while to learn, and frankly, I don't have it mastered yet. Anyhow, over the last decade or so, I realized that there were a lot of inconsistencies in the ways we talk about empathy. Is it about emotions? Is it about mind reading? Is it active, intuitive, somatic, intellectual, instinctual? So, I did what I always do when I'm presented with conflicting information. Research. Here's what I discovered. Ask 100 people what empathy is, and you'll get 100 different answers. Neuroscientists, philosophers, psychologists, psychotherapists, sociologists, management consultants, and TED Talk givers all seem to have different definitions. And even within fields, there is little agreement on what empathy is. For this series, my research focused on ideas of empathy as they relate to philosophy of mind, pop culture, and the workplace. Now, speaking of pop culture, fiction can provide a profound window into how others behave, communicate, think, and feel. It can also perpetuate stereotypes and objectify people. In Richard Powers' critically acclaimed 2021 novel, Bewilderment, a neuroscientist creates what the narrator Theo describes as an empathy machine. Now, unlike my own empathy engine, this empathy machine is an fMRI machine. The scientist uses the fMRI machine to map how emotions affect someone's brain and then uses those maps to stimulate emotional responses in another person's brain. Robin is Theo's son, and he has trouble at school. Or maybe he has trouble at life. His dad tells the scientist that Robin's various doctors have given him 2 votes for Asperger's, 1 probably OCD, and 1 possible ADHD. Theo hopes that the neuroscientist will agree to treat Robin using the empathy machine to, quote, calm him down and get his principal off his back. So, Robin goes into the empathy machine, and eventually, they decide to use the brain scan that belonged to his mother, who passed away before the events of the novel, to train Robin's brain. Robin's affect and behavior improve. He seems happier and more focused. He has fewer outbursts and idiosyncrasies. The treatment, however, doesn't last. The neuroscientist's lab gets shut down by the government. Robin and Theo try to maintain the changes as best they can, but it doesn't work. As he loses access to his mother's feelings, Robin fearfully tells his dad, "I don't want to go back to being me. I've gone through mild manic periods when I didn't want to go back to being me either. Times I felt like I was finally speaking everyone else's language, even though I was merely surfing waves of serotonin and dopamine. But those weren't healthy times. They weren't times when I was fully myself. The highs can be just as dissociating as the lows. When I'm speaking my own language, when the mask is off, the autistic experience is thrilling. I'd never want to give it up, not in a million years. Just because someone else can't imagine that experience or the delight that can come with it doesn't make it wrong. Yes, fiction helps us understand foreign perspectives when the author has done the work to imagine the inner worlds of their characters in all their messy, contradictory, and sparkling beauty. However, when authors rely on tropes or assumptions about those inner lives, they cheat us out of that empathic experience. Now, spoilers. I was shocked when the novel ended with Robin's death. Robin is portrayed not as a victim of other people's limited capacity for connecting with him, but as a victim of his own disordered neurology. He's overcome by irrationality. And if it hadn't been clear all along, it was now painfully obvious that Robin was nothing more than a plot device designed to shine a light on the neurotypical protagonist. So much for empathy. Autistic people like me, and presumably Robin, are often thought to lack empathy. Our social differences are labeled as deficits. Our own norms are dismissed as symptoms of a bigger problem. In 2012, sociologist and autism researcher Damian Milton published a paper identifying what he called the double empathy problem. Milton, who is autistic himself, wanted to investigate the ontological status of autism. That is, what even is it? Is autism a neurological disorder that requires treatment? Or is it a difference in processing and interacting with the world? Milton unsurprisingly sees autism as a difference rather than a disorder. He argues that the emotional and interpersonal challenges that come with autism are socially constructed rather than inherent to the condition. In other words, autistic people have difficulty in social situations not because we have an inability to function in those situations, but because we speak a different language than the neurotypical people who perceive our interaction as odd. In fact, this is exactly the metaphor that autism advocate Jim Sinclair used in their powerful essay, Don't Mourn for Us. They write, "It takes more work to communicate with someone whose native language isn't the same as yours, and autism goes deeper than language and culture. Autistic people are foreigners in any society." I love this metaphor because it highlights a key facet of the double empathy problem. No one is surprised to discover that they communicate more easily with someone who speaks the same language as they do than someone who doesn't. Of course, social interaction among autistic people has its own difficulties, but generally speaking, there is a broader awareness and accommodation of different behaviors and affects than in an interaction with a neurotypical person. That's the double part of the double empathy problem. Autistic people may struggle with the social norms of non-autistic people, but non-autistic people struggle with the social expression of autistic people too. It goes both ways. In bewilderment, Robin displays tons of empathy long before he ever enters the empathy machine. But Robin's empathy language is different from his father's, his principal's, or the scientist's. Instead of recognizing that Robin speaks a different language, they want to fix him and force him to speak the same language as everyone else. They have little to no interest in speaking Robin's language. This is the irony of Powers actually including a Greta Thunberg stand-in character who claims autism is her special asset. She's overflowing with empathy, the kind of empathy that roils with righteous anger when others are subject to injustice. Unsurprisingly, Robin sees himself in her. "She's like me," he tells his dad. Two people speaking the same language, empathy recognizing empathy. Damian Milton points out that normal is always determined by the dominant group. So autistic people get labeled as having an empathy deficit that needs to be corrected, rather than a difference that deserves to be recognized. Non-autistic people want autistic people to learn to speak a non-autistic language because that's the normal language. But that's about the same as an American going to France and expecting all French people to speak English because English is normal. All right, this is where we circle back to the origin story of empathy. Autistic people do not lack empathy, as is the stereotype. Autistic people experience and express empathy differently. So again, that begs the question, what the hell is empathy? And what does it mean for empathy to be an in-demand soft skill at work? For a word used so frequently across so many domains, contemporary philosophers and psychologists don't have a set definition of what empathy is. Philosopher Amy Copeland describes the various definitions of empathy as one or more of several loosely related processes or mental states, such as feeling what someone else feels, caring about someone else, being emotionally affected by someone else's emotions and experience, though not necessarily experiencing the same emotions, imagining being another in that other's situation, making inferences about another's mental states, or some combination of those processes. But Copeland's own definition is worth examining, especially in the context of empathy at work. She writes, quote, "Empathy is a complex imaginative process in which an observer simulates another person's situated psychological states while maintaining clear self-other differentiation." Got it? No? Okay. Let me attempt to put that into something resembling casual speech. Empathy is both an intellectual and emotional process that imagines what another person might be experiencing in a given situation without projecting one's own mental state or taking on the mental state of the other. Now, let's break this down. One, empathy can be cognitive and or affective. Affective empathy is the emotional process. It's the feeling into that we find in a lot of management or self-help literature dealing with empathy. Affective empathy is experienced in a few different ways based on whether the feeling in question has more to do with the empathizer or the subject of the empathy. Now, cognitive empathy is an intellectual process. It's the ability to reason what another person might believe, intend, or feel. Cognitive empathy is what I described when I told you about my empathy engine or the perspective map. It's a conscious process based on inference and deduction that imagines the mental state of another person. Two, empathy is a product of imagination. Imagining someone's mental state requires curiosity about their experience, emotions, and inner narrative. Assuming that another person would respond to a situation the same way I would isn't very imaginative. In this way, practicing empathy demands that we set aside our own cognitive and emotional patterns so we can recognize and appreciate the differences other people experience. And three, empathy is situational. Obviously, someone's mental state is going to vary depending on the situation they're in, but it doesn't vary only on the visible and contemporaneous details of the situation. Someone's mental state will vary depending on something that happened to them an hour ago, a year ago, or a decade ago. It varies based on their self-confidence that day or the conversation they had with their therapist last week. Practicing empathy, therefore, requires open-mindedness. We'll never have all the information we need to understand someone else's mental state fully. And if we forget that, we're likely to jump to conclusions or ignore information that could offer insight. Now, open-mindedness is especially needed when practicing empathy with people who don't belong to the same group you do. While the research and theory on this effect are mixed, it seems likely that what's perceived as empathic behavior can actually, one, activate stereotypes or prejudices about people in the out-group, or two, lead to justification of existing social systems or interpersonal relations. Milton's double empathy problem can be applied here, too. It's easier to empathize with people who speak the same language you do, and that can extend to all sorts of identities beyond neurodiversity, including race, religion, sexuality, gender, and many, many more. Frankly, when we have more similarities and fewer differences relative to others, our empathy doesn't need to be as imaginative. How we feel or what we think is likely to be how another feels or what another thinks. But when those differences start to outweigh the similarities, our empathy engines need to work harder. It takes more creativity for me to imagine how someone whose identities are very different from mine would think or feel. If all we do is practice empathy within our own group, our empathy gets lazy. When it comes to empathy, my otherness is a superpower. I never assume I'm more like someone than I really am because I am acutely aware of my otherness in any social situation. I have to imagine what it's like to be someone else because I know I can't rely on my own inner world as a template for theirs. In this way, empathy is always constructed. We remain separate from the object of our empathy, never knowing whether what we perceive as a shared feeling reflects the emotional landscape of the other. Empathy is always our best guess, an approximation based on context clues. And even that, a context clue, is no objective reality. The clue itself might be context for constructing the empathetic affect, but the context of the clue is also up for interpretation. A gray cloud on a hot summer afternoon means something different than a gray cloud on a crisp winter morning. The clue is the same, but the context changes how I perceive it. Social context is always a moving target. I know that a hot summer afternoon brings with it the chance of stray thunderstorms moving from west to east. Although, sometimes not. I know that the context of a conversation or shared activity shifts and changes. And just as I can be caught off guard by a sudden summer storm coming from the east, I can be caught off guard by an unexpected change in the social weather. And truthfully, I often get wet. But that isn't a lack of empathy. We all get wet. Now, certainly any effort at perspective taking and compassion is a step in the right direction. But we ignore the deeper and more profound language of empathy at our peril. If what passes for empathy is assuming that what you feel must be what I feel, we're in trouble. Empathy isn't based on assumptions, but on curiosity. It's not based on similarity, but on difference. Empathy requires that we recognize that difference. If we don't, it's not empathy, it's just projection. I project my feelings or thinking on you, you project yours on me. That doesn't get us any closer to understanding each other. It doesn't help me anticipate what you might need or how we might better work together. Philosopher Simone Weil called this dimension of empathy attention. Attention, for Weil, requires forgetting oneself and focusing exclusively on the other. She writes, quote, "The soul empties itself of all its contents in order to receive into itself the being it is looking at, just as he is in all his truth." To offer attention, she explained, simply means being able to say to another, "What are you going through?" That kind of attention is the recognition that the other exists not as a member of a group or a person dealing with a certain brand of situation, but as an individual worthy of attention, just as we are. They believed that the capacity for attention was rare. She writes, "It is almost a miracle. It is a miracle. Nearly all those who think they have this capacity do not possess it. Warmth of heart, impulsiveness, pity are not enough." They lived this philosophy. It was never enough for her to contemplate the other. She had to experience what the other was going through. She wanted to be among people who were suffering so that she could better understand their needs and their desires. While she never stopped embodying the scholar and philosopher, it's why she left the profession to experience work in a factory. It's why she went to the front lines of the Spanish Civil War. Her desire for self-denial and the experience of other suffering might have even led to her untimely death in 1943 at the age of 34. Today, many autistic people claim they as one of our own. I do. She speaks my language. I recognize my own fire in her fire, my own awkwardness in her awkwardness, my own curiosity in her curiosity. What I wouldn't give to offer her my full attention, my full empathy, and ask her, what are you going through? Vey's version of attention and empathy isn't the kind heralded by thought leaders as the solution to every business problem that ails you. It can't be. To forget yourself, you'd need to forget profit or KPIs first. To ask another, what are you going through, with the kind of curiosity Vey embodied, you'd need to forget that you were using empathy as a product development, marketing, or management tool. Attention isn't attached to outcomes. Empathy doesn't concern itself with what's in it for me. Neither are tools for forcing us into emotional and experiential sameness, all the better to create ads for. Nope. What we've come to call empathy in the world of work and business is far from an effort to really understand what someone else is going through, as best I can tell. Lessons in corporate empathy might give the ambitious manager enough to get by with a Taurus-level grasp of the language. Their empathy expressed in the equivalent of please, thank you, and where is the bathroom? What we really need to transform the world of work and business for the better is a full immersion empathy experience. Thanks for listening to part one of my new series on empathy. If you got something out of it, maybe an itch to notice when your empathy might be getting a little lazy, I'd so appreciate if you shared this episode with a friend. You can send them to whatworkspodcast.com or to whatworks.fyi, where every episode is also published as an essay. My work on subjects like empathy, the self-help industry, and time is possible only because of listeners and readers who chip in as premium subscribers. If you enjoy What Works and you want to see this kind of thinking continue, please consider upgrading if you have the means. For just $7 per month, you get access to my premium columns, live quarterly workshops, and discussion threads. Go to whatworks.fyi to upgrade. That's whatworks.fyi. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.